Hello.
Recording.
Absolute pleasure to sort of hear early on in that meeting introduction there. The people that are days sober, and I remember sitting in my first meeting and listening to guys that were sort of 7 years sober, 19 years sober, 25 years sober, and I thought, how on earth did you get there? I remember seeing people laughing and joking in a meeting when I was sat there, absolutely falling apart inside, that my life had come to wreck and ruin. It was completely unmanageable, and I just did not understand how these people were happy and how these people were free. But I can sit here today saying that I am a happy, recovered alcoholic that is 1,666 days sober, one day at a time, by the grace of God. I'm going to share my experience, strength and hope with you, the experience of what life were like while drinking, the strength that I gained from a higher power and a God of my understanding, my sort of hope for the future in fulfilling step 12, which I'm so thankful you're giving me the opportunity to do now. So I'm coming from Leeds in the UK, in the wonderful county of Yorkshire. Commonly known locally as God's own country. We've got some luscious green rolling hills, and it's a real wonderful place to visit if any of you guys ever get over here. But yeah, what qualifies me to sit and speak this evening, humbly, is the fact that whenever I take any form of alcohol into my system, ever, it kickstarts a craving. The craving don't develop before the drink, it develops after the drink. Once it's hit the stomach, that's when I crave another. And every single time I take any form of alcohol, especially towards the back end, when I passed the point of no return, every time I took alcohol, I got drunk. And that led me to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Many of these things that we hear in the book. So back in 2021, it was the 5th of December when I got sober, when I hit the first meeting. But the sort of last 5 years of my sobriety running up to that point were the worst. That's when I relate to Bill's story, in the sense that I was, well, not Bill's story, sorry, a little bit further on in the book. I relate to the fact that the book saved many of us from that sort of final 10 or 20 years of absolute hell. I managed to get to the rooms before I lost absolutely everything, but I were at a point where if I'd have continued going on and living the way that I was living, I would have no doubt lost absolutely everything, including my sanity. So yeah, I have two children. I have a wonderful partner. At the time that I was in the cups at the worst, I had an £80,000 a year job. I had a wonderful car sat on my drive, a lovely house to live in. And I had this problem with alcohol that once I started to drink, I could never stop. And that's what confused me. I had a relatively healthy relationship with alcohol up until about the age of 25, between 25 and 30. I went through heavy stages of binges and then stopping. I always remember looking back and thinking that, do you know, I'm not an alcoholic because I live in a house. I'm not an alcoholic because, do you know, I'm not brown bagging it on a park bench. Do you know, I had this image, this image that's sort of given to me from a worldly view of, we view an alcoholic as somebody sort of sat on a street, rope holding his trousers up, and that kind of look. And I think my own ego kept me from accepting that I was alcoholic for a long time, because I thought I had a lot of things in life that stopped me from being that, but that wasn't true. I remember drinking escalating when I left home. I moved in with my partner for the first time. We were expecting our first child, and I remember And this is where I can sort of relate to Bill's story a little bit is I remember getting into that little, we lived in a little one-story house, we call them bungalows over here, a little one-story house, and we were getting our own fridge freezer for the first time. We were getting our own sort of goods for the kitchen, and I started to fill the fridge with beer, and I started to feel like I had a sense that I'd arrived in life, that I'd made it, that I was an independent person, that I was a man, and that I could kind of drink as and when I wanted. And like I say, it's drink for a while. It didn't affect me, do you know. I had certain binges where I went off track, but I could quite easily sort of pull that in. But there were a point that I passed where I lost control altogether. When it got bad, it got really bad. Alcohol had become my master. And I couldn't escape it. I have, as I previously mentioned, I've got a lovely family. I've got lovely friends around me. I've got a brother, that sort of used to come down and he'd look at everything that I've got and he'd say, "God, what on earth do you do this for? Why on earth do you put yourself through this kind of this hell and this torture when you've got so much to live for?" And I could never give him the answers, but. So to give you an example of my drinking and experiences, we had I always reference and I reference this story and I always point to this story so that I can help other alcoholics out there recognize that this is a problem that centers in the mind rather than in the body. It's the mind that gets us into the trouble all the time. And when my daughter was about 4 years old, she developed a blood condition. She got really poorly. She started to look really pale, and she needed to go into hospital. And she were in hospital having some extensive blood tests done, and it was looking like that she was suffering from leukemia. She wasn't, and she hasn't. It were a different kind of condition that she had at the time, which was treated, and she's very healthy and she's very happy today. But nevertheless, going back to the point where we were told as parents, your daughter might have leukemia. I remember leaving the hospital with my partner, and when we left that hospital, we were driving home, and my partner said, "Look, we best stop. Best get some food, do you know." None of us have eaten. And I remember thinking at that point, "How on earth can you be thinking about food?" Do you know? I thought it was selfish of her to be thinking about food. And we pulled over at a McDonald's and we got some food for my daughter, some food for my partner. And I said, "I don't need to eat. I couldn't eat. I feel sick. My throat's closed." We continued home. And when we got home, we all walked into the house and I put my hand on a bottle of beer in the fridge. And my partner looked at me and said, "How can you be thinking about taking a drink right now?" Do you know? And that was the difference. See, my partner had the ability at that point in her life to think about our daughter. She knew that she needed to nourish herself in order to take care of her. And all I had the ability to do was to think about the way I felt inside. And the only thing I knew how to deal with that was to drink alcohol because it had numbed that pain. So going forward from that, I have done everything from take money from my children's piggy banks, take money off of my partner, lie to people around me, my parents, brothers, sisters, manipulation, everything that I've, all the tools that we use as alcoholics in order to get our own way, to drink. And on the 5th of December, after consuming over £1,000 worth of cocaine, and I'm conscious we're in an AA meeting here, and that's where I'll leave that. And drinking a bottle of rum, a couple of bottles of red, driving a van around, and abandoning that vehicle, and having my young family come out and sort of rescue me from side of a road. I'd reached a breaking point. I'd reached a point where I thought enough's enough. I thought I can't go on in this agony anymore. And I remember that next few days we were sat on a sofa. I was sat on my sofa. My children were really poorly at the time, And I remember sitting on my sofa, and my partner had said to me, "You know, tonight we're gonna, I want us to act like a normal family for the sake of these children, you know, and they're not well, they need some rest. I want us to act like a normal family, and then tomorrow we'll sort of deal with what's going on between us." But it was ultimately over, you know, she'd had enough. And I remember sitting on the sofa that night, contemplating jumping out of my living room window, running down to the local off licence and taking a bottle of vodka. And it was that thought that scared me. And I picked up my phone, and I Googled. I'd been through AA, I'd been through an organisation called Forward Leeds that I'd attended for 4 weeks. I had to give a urine sample. Everything were all right. After 4 weeks, they said, "You're good, you can go. You sort of pretty much cured." Do you know, I'm not saying it's a bad organisation, but I'm saying that if you're truly alcoholic, there's only one thing that's going to save you, and that's God. I went to counselling. I paid a counsellor £160 an hour for them to sort of tell me that there was some kind of repressed childhood trauma. I went to see my local GP and doctor, who put me on antidepressants and put me on a waiting list for sort of cognitive behavioural therapy and other things. I were on an anti-anxiety tablet for a while. These were all sort of synthetic things that the book says doctors and physicians will deal with us. Nobody at any one point said, "Do you think you need to ground your ideals in a power greater than yourself in order to recreate your life?" But that's what the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous taught me once I got there. I managed to get to the meeting on the 5th of December 2021. I walked past it a few times, and a guy outside, he must have seen my liking, he must have seen people like me, and he said, "Are you looking for AA, mate?" And everything inside me at that moment wanted to say, "No, I'm fine." And I just said, "Yeah." And he said, "Come upstairs, we'll make you a cup of tea, we'll sit you down." And I remember sitting in that circle with those men and witnessing people happy and joyous and free. I remember seeing that in people, and in deep down inside me, I was thinking, "How on earth can you be laughing? What is there to laugh about in this life?" Do you know? And I sat there with a judgmental view of every single person that was sat in the room. I was looking at the colour of people's skin, I was looking at the size of people's waists, and I was sat there a disgusting, despicable person, so selfish and self-centred that I could not get out of myself one little bit to hear a message of hope whatsoever. And I listened to a guy share for 20 minutes. He was talking about God, he was talking about all these higher powers, and I'm sitting there thinking, as soon as he shuts up, I'm getting out of here, I can do this, I can fix it. So faced with everything in my life that were destroying me and bringing me down, I still had that overriding thought that that selfish, self-centered, that ego drive that I can still succeed in this on my own, even though countless times I'd failed. I still thought that I could do something about it. And then the floor of that AA meeting opened up, and people started to share back about where they hid the alcohol. They started to share back about what they did with the bank accounts. They started to share back about how they pinched money off of other people. They started to share back about manipulation, and they grabbed me. In that single moment, I thought, I'm sat with people that know exactly how I feel and exactly how I think. And a guy put his hand on my shoulder and he said, "Keep coming back, Eddie, and it'll get better." And I did exactly what he said. I kept going back. I got numbers off people, and I mean, I was that new and that sort of green behind the gills, if you like. But they were talking about a big book, and I remember thinking I had to go out and buy a big journal, like a really big jotter, and all looking around stationery stores for like really big writing pads. I didn't actually know what a big book was, do you know? And that's why whenever somebody comes into a meeting today, I'm always really quick to say, "This is what a big book is, do you know, and this is what's going to save your life." In actual fact, it's the first 164 pages of that that'll save your life, and the rest of it is just testament and stories of people that have done the work. At 6 months sober, 6 months I spent bouncing around the rooms of AA, jumping into water, buying new trainers, getting myself a little bit healthier, eating lots of food, chewing lots of sweets, drinking lots of sugary pop. And at 6 months, I got to a point where I were at a jumping off point. I'd not touched a step. I knew enough about alcoholism that I couldn't drink safely, but I'd not put enough of the work in to recover happily. And I sat in a meeting and I shared in a meeting, and there were a guy that was travelling. He travelled up from the south of England up to Leeds for a convention, and I shared openly and honestly, and he shared, and I heard him, and I went and I spoke to him during that meeting, and he looked at me after that meeting and he said, "Eddie, if you don't do what this book requires you to do, if you don't let me take you through these steps, then you will die." And he had the courage to tell me that. Do you know, many a times I see people coming into AA nowadays, and I hear this keep coming back, and I hear these messages of almost frothy emotional appeal, and it's nice and it's endearing, and I love it. And there is an element of love that we've got to carry to these lost souls that are so isolated and so lonely. But we also have to have the courage to say, if you don't do this, you are going to die. And it was that message that carried the depth and weight. It was that message in the front of the book, the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism, that saved my life, because I heard that I could recover from it, that I could live happily. It took me through steps one through three, and I realized that I had to give up everything, everything that I thought about. I give up everything about self-will, and it took me sort of steps four through seven, and I realized that I had to fess up and get a lot of stuff out, and it wasn't an easy process, but he certainly lovingly guided me throughout that process, and then he took me sort of steps eight and nine, where I had to make up. I had to go out there into the world, and I had to make amends with people. And then I live now every single day, steps 10 through 12, fulfilling that this very moment in time. Just sharing my experience, strength, and hope with other people, and intensively working with other alcoholics. I sponsor a lot of guys, and I don't say that in an egotistical way, but I do sponsor, and I have contact with a lot of guys in the fellowship that certainly keep me sober. I've spent the last sort of 6 weeks of my life working away from home in a position where I can't actually get to physical meetings, in a position where I'm sort of, I do need to find a bit of balance in life, but I'm not sat here today thinking, "Oh, I've got to get to a meeting, I've got to get to a meeting, I've got to get to a meeting." I'm sat here in a position where I feel safe and protected, where I feel in a position of neutrality. I'm sat here today where I'm in regular contact with the fellowship, and that's why that message on that very opening page, that's the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism, it is true to my life and the way I work the program today. So the one thing that keeps me sober is God. It's a higher power, and it will ground in my ideals in that higher power. Do you know, I have a faith today that through using step 11, through trying to seek this conscious contact with a higher power through prayer and meditation, through multiple different forms of literature, through open, non-judgmental discussions with other people about their faith, I've managed to put firm roots down onto firm, solid ground. And it's a fellowship like no other, is Alcoholics Anonymous. I could talk about it for the next hour. I could put so much into it that I could probably bore you all to sleep. But today I live an absolutely amazing, wonderful, happy, joyous, and free life where alcohol is no longer a problem. Do you know? And on Saturday, at a church in Whitkirk, in the UK, the woman that were about to leave me 4.5 years ago accepted a ring, and we got married. My daughters were there. My daughter sang us down the aisle. We had friends from the fellowship that were there. We had a little table set up at the back with candles on it, dedicated to members of my family, to members of my partner's family that have sadly lost their life to alcoholism. But I often used to listen to this, to these tales of, "Oh, if you keep doing this, you'll get a life beyond your wildest dreams," which you don't really see it in the book, but you do hear about it in the in the rooms of AA, and you hear about it from people around. And I always used to see that life beyond my wildest dreams as sort of supercars and big houses and foreign holidays. And in actual fact, that life beyond my wildest dreams is to be able to sit in isolation today, just me and God, comfortably at peace and at ease. That life beyond my wildest dreams is to experience joy and happiness in a moment where I'm no longer somewhere else in my head. So I can see that I've got 3 seconds left. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak this evening. Good luck to everybody that started out in this meeting that saw 12 days, 22 days, 70 odd days, to keep going. But please, as my sponsor said to me 4.5 years ago, if you don't do the work necessary in this book, you will die. Please, please listen to that.